The silver-haired girl backed up, launched herself through the hole, and gracefully somersaulted next to us, grabbing Leo's discarded hammer as she stood.
"More weapons," the girl demanded. "I need more weapons."
"Yes," I thought. "Definitely a hunter of Artemis." Leo pulled out a selection of tools for the girl's consideration.
I got a screwdriver, a hacksaw, and I think this is a cheese cutter."
The girl wrinkled her nose.
"What are you, a tinkerer?"
"That's Lord Tinkerer to you."
The girl swiped the tools.
"I'll take them all."
She scowled at me.
"What about your bow?"
"You can't have my bow," I said.
"I'm Apollo."
Her expression changed from shock to understanding to forced calm. I guessed the plight of Lester Papadopoulos was known among the hunters.
"Right," the girl said. "The rest of the hunters should be on their way." I was the nearest to Indianapolis. I decided to play advance scout. Obviously, that didn't work out so well for me.
"In fact," I said, "there was an incursion at the front gates a few minutes ago. I suspect your comrades have arrived." Her eyes darkened.
"We need to leave then, quickly."
Meg helped the emaciated boys from their cell. Up close, they looked even more pathetic and fragile, which made me angrier.
"Prisoners should never be treated this way," I growled.
"Oh, they weren't denied food," the silver-haired girl said, admiration creeping into her voice.
"They've been on a hunger strike. Courageous for a couple of boys. I'm Hunter Kowalski, by the way."
I frowned. "A hunter named Hunter?"
"Yeah, I have heard that a million times. Let's free the others."
I found no convenient switch box to lower the glass doors, but with Meg and Leo's help, we began slowly liberating the captives. Most seemed to be human or demigod. It was difficult to tell which. But one was a Dracaena. She looked human enough from the waist up, but where her legs should have been, twin snake tails undulated.
"She's friendly," Hunter assured us. "We shared a cell last night until the guards separated us. Her name's Sarah, with 5 S's.
That was good enough for me.
We let her out.
The next cell held a lone young man who looked like a professional wrestler. He wore only a red and white loincloth with matching beads around his neck, but he did not seem underdressed. Just as gods are often depicted nude because they are perfect beings, this prisoner had no reason to hide his body. With his dark, glossy skin, his shaved head, and his muscular arms and chest, he looked like a teak warrior brought to life through the craft of Hephaestus. I made a mental note to ask Hephaestus about such a project later. His eyes, also teak brown, were piercing and angry. Beautiful in the way only dangerous things can be. Tattooed on his right shoulder was a symbol I did not recognize. Some sort of a double-bladed axe. Leo fired up his hands to melt the glass, but the Dracaena Sarah hissed.
"Not that one," she warned. "Too dangerous."
Leo frowned. "Lady, we need dangerous friends."
"Yes, but that one fought for money. He was employed by the Emperor. He's only here now because he did something to anger Commodus."
I studied tall, dark, and handsome. I know that's a cliche, but he really was all three. I didn't intend to leave anyone behind, especially someone who wore a loincloth so well.
We're going to free you, I shouted through the glass. Not sure how much he could hear. Please don't kill us. We are enemies of Commodus, the man who put you here. TD and H's expression did not change. Part anger, part disdain, part indifference. The same way Zeus looked every morning before his coffee-infused nectar. Leo, I said. Do it. Valdez melted the glass. TD and H stepped out slowly and gracefully, as if he had all the time in the world. Hello, I said. I'm the immortal god Apollo. Who might you be? His voice rolled like thunder.
I am Jamie.
A noble name, I decided. Worthy of kings. Apollo, Meg called. Get over here. She was staring into the last cell. Of course it would be the last cell. Hunched in the corner, sitting on a familiar bronze suitcase, was a young girl in a lavender wool sweater and green jeans. On her lap sat a plate of prison slop, which she was using to finger paint on the wall. Her tufts of brown hair looked like she'd cut them herself with gardening shears. She was large for her age, about Leo's size, but her babyish face told me she couldn't have been more than 7. Georgina, I said. Leo scowled. Why is she sitting on Festus? Why would they put him in there with her? I didn't have an answer, but I motioned for Meg to cut through the glass wall. Let me go first, I said. I stepped through. Georgie? The girl's eyes were like fractured prisms, swirling with unanchored thoughts and waking nightmares. I knew that look too well. Over the centuries, I'd seen many mortal minds broken under the weight of prophecy.
Apollo!
She let out a burst of giggles, as if her brain had developed a leak.
You and the dark! Some death. Some death. Some death.
24. Science can be fun. Squirt those toxic chemicals. Anywhere, really. Georgina grabbed my wrist, sending an unpleasant chill up my forearm.
Some death.
On the list of things that freaked me out, 7-year-old girls who giggled about death were right at the top, along with reptiles and talking weapons. I remembered the prophetic limerick that had brought us west. The warning that I would be forced death and madness to swallow. Clearly, Georgina had encountered such horrors in the cave of Trophonius. I did not fancy following her example. For one thing, I had zero skill at painting with prison slop. Yes, I said agreeably. We can talk more about death once we get you home. Emmy and Josephine sent me to get you.
Home?
Georgina spoke the word as if it were a difficult term from a foreign language. Leo got impatient. He climbed into the cell and trotted over. Hey, Georgie, I'm Leo. That's a nice suitcase. Can I see it? Georgina tilted her head.
My clothes.
Oh, yeah. Leo brushed the name tag on his borrowed coveralls. Sorry about the sewage stains and the burning smell. I'll get them cleaned.
The burning hot,
Georgie said.
You. All of it.
Right. Leo smiled uncertainly. Ladies often tell me I'm all the burning hot. But don't worry. I won't set you on fire or anything. I offered Georgie my hand. Here, child. We'll take you home. She was content to let me help her. As soon as she was on her feet, Leo rushed to the bronze suitcase and began fussing over it. Oh, buddy, I'm so sorry, he murmured. I should never have left you. I'll get you back to the weigh station for a good tune-up. Then you can have all the Tabasco sauce and motor oil you want. The suitcase did not respond. Leo managed to activate its wheels and handles so he could lug it out of the cell. Georgina remained docile until she saw Meg. Then suddenly she had a burst of strength worthy of me.
No!
She yanked herself from my grip and plunged back into her cell. I tried to calm her, but she continued to howl and stare at Meg in horror.
Nero! Nero!
Meg did her famous turn-to-cement expression, shutting down all emotion, extinguishing all light from her eyes. Hunter Kowalski rushed in to help with Georgie.
Hey, 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 hey.
She stroked the girl's ratty hair.
It's okay. We're friends.
Nero!
Georgie shrieked again. Hunter frowned at Meg.
What's she talking about?
Meg stared down at her high tops.
I can leave.
We're all leaving, I insisted. Georgie, this is Meg. She escaped from Nero, that's true. But she's on our side. I decided not to add, except for that one time she betrayed me to her stepfather and almost got me killed. I didn't want to complicate matters. In Hunter's kind embrace, Georgie calmed down. Her wide eyes and trembling body reminded me of a terrified bird held in cupped hands.
You and death and fire.
Suddenly she giggled.
The chair, the chair, the chair.
Ah, taters, I cursed. She's right. We still need the chair. Tall, dark, and Jamie appeared on my left, a brooding presence not unlike a storm front.
What chair is this?
A throne, I said. Magical. We need it to cure Georgie. From the blank looks of the prisoners, I guessed I wasn't making much sense. I also realized I couldn't ask the entire group to go tromping through the palace in search of a piece of furniture, especially not the half-starved boys or the Dracaena, who, not having feet, was incapable of tromping. Nor was Georgie likely to go anywhere with Meg, not without a great deal of shrieking. We'll have to split up, I decided. Leo, you know the way back to the sewer tunnel. Take our new friends with you. Hopefully the guards will still be distracted. Meg and I will find the chair. Leo glanced at his beloved dragon suitcase, then at Meg and me, then at the prisoners. Just you and Meg?
Go,
Meg said, careful to avoid Georgie's eyes.
We'll be okay.
What if the guards aren't distracted? Leo asked. Or if we have to fight that snake thingy again? Jamie rumbled.
Snake thingy.
I resent your choice of words,
said Sarah. Leo sighed.
I don't mean you.
It's a, well, you'll see. Maybe you can talk to it and convince it to let us pass? He sized up Jamie. Or if not, the monster's probably about the right size for you to make a belt out of. Sarah hissed in disapproval. Hunter Kowalski wrapped her arms protectively around Georgie.
We'll get everyone to safety, she promised. Apollo, Meg, thank you. If you see the Emperor, send him to Tartarus for me.
Pleasure, I said. In the hallway, alarms began to blare. Leo led our new friends back the way we'd come. Hunter held Georgina's hand, while Jamie and Sarah propped up the hunger strike boys. Once the group disappeared around the corner,
Meg walked to her little patch of chia. She closed her eyes in concentration. Faster than you could say ch-ch-ch-chia, the sprouts went into overdrive, spreading across the corridor like a fast-motion sheet of green ice. Sprouts wove together from ceiling to floor, wall to wall, until the hallway was clogged with an impassable curtain of plants. Impressive, I said, though I was also thinking, well, we won't be exiting that way. Meg nodded. It'll slow down anybody chasing our friends. Come on, the chair is down here. How do you know? Rather than answering, she dashed off. Since she was the one with all the cool powers, I decided to follow. Alarms continued to blare, the noise stabbing my eardrums like hot skewers. Red lights swept the corridors, turning Meg's blades the color of blood. We poked our heads inside the Commodus Stolen Art Gallery, the Commodus Imperial Cafe, and the Commodus Care Infirmary. We saw no one and found no magical thrones. Finally, Meg stopped at a steel door. At least I assumed it was a door. It had no handle, lock, or visible hinges. It was just a featureless rectangle of metal set in the wall. It's in here, she said. How can you tell? She gave me her nya-nya-nya look, the kind of expression your mother used to warn you about. If you make that face, it'll stick. I'd always taken this threat seriously, since divine mothers are fully capable of making it happen.
It's like the trees, dummy.
I blinked. You mean how you led us to the Grove of Dodona?
Yeah.
You can sense the throne of Namazani? Because it is made of magical wood?
To know, I guess.
That seemed like a stretch, even for a powerful daughter of Demeter. I didn't know how the throne of Namazani had been created. It certainly might have been carved from some special tree from a sacred forest. Gods loved that sort of thing. If so, Meg might have been able to sense the chair. I wondered if she could find me a magical dining table once I got back to Olympus. I really needed one with fold-out leaves for accommodating the nine muses at Thanksgiving. Meg tried slicing the door the way she had with the glass walls in the prison. Her swords didn't even scratch the metal. She tried wedging her blades into the door frame. No luck. She stepped back and frowned at me.
Open it.
Me? I felt sure she was picking on me because I was the only enslaved god she had. I'm not Hermes. I'm not even Valdez.
Try.
As if that were a simple request. I attempted all the obvious methods. I shoved the door. I kicked it. I attempted to get my fingertips under the edges and pry it open. I spread my arms and yelled the standard magic words. Melon! Shazam! Sesame Street! None of these worked. At last, I tried my infallible ace in the hole. I sang Love is an Open Door from the Frozen soundtrack. Even this failed. Impossible, I cried. This door has no taste in music.
Be more gaudy,
Meg suggested. If I could be more gaudy, I wanted to scream, I wouldn't be here. I ran down the list of things I used to be the god of. Archery, poetry, flirting, sunlight, music, medicine, prophecy, flirting. None of these would open a literal stainless steel door. Wait. I thought back to the last room we'd peeked in. The Commodus Care Infirmary. Medical supplies. Meg peered at me from behind her filmy cat-eye lenses.
You're going to heal the door?
Not exactly. Come with me.
In the infirmary, I riffled through supply cabinets, filling a small cardboard box with potentially useful items. Medical tape, oral syringes, scalpels, ammonia, distilled water, baking soda. Then finally, aha! In triumph, I held up a bottle labeled H2SO4.
Oil of vitriol.
Meg edged away.
What is that?
You'll see. I grabbed some safety equipment. Gloves, mask, goggles. The sort of stuff I would not have bothered with as a god. Let's go, Chia girl.
It sounded better when Leo said it, she complained. But she followed me out.
Back at the steel door, I suited up. I readied two syringes, one with vitriol, one with water. Meg, stand back.
Okay.
She pinched her nose against the stench as I squirted oil of vitriol around the door. Vaporous tendrils curled from the seams.
What is that stuff?
Back in medieval times, I said, we used oil of vitriol for its healing properties. No doubt that's why Commodus had some in his infirmary. Today, we call it sulfuric acid. Meg flinched.
Isn't that dangerous?
Very.
And you healed with it?
It was the Middle Ages. We were crazy back then. I held up the second syringe, the one filled with water. Meg, what I'm about to do, never, ever try this on your own. I felt a bit silly giving this advice to a girl who regularly fought monsters with golden swords, but I had promised Bill Nye the Science Guy I would always promote safe laboratory practices.
What's going to happen?
She asked. I stepped back and squirted water into the door seams. Immediately, the acid began to hiss and spit, more aggressively than the Carthaginian serpent. To speed the process along, I sang a song of heat and corrosion. I chose Frank Ocean, since his soulful power could burn its way through even the hardest substances. The door groaned and creaked. At last it fell inward, leaving a steaming wreath of mist around the frame.
Whoa!
Meg said, which was probably the highest compliment she'd ever given me. I pointed to the cardboard supply box near her feet. Hand me that baking soda, would you? I sprinkled powder liberally around the doorway to neutralize the acid. I couldn't help smirking at my own ingenuity. I hoped Athena was watching, because wisdom, baby! And I did it with so much more style than old gray eyes. I bowed to Meg with a flourish. After you, Chia girl.
You actually did something good,
she noted. You just had to step on my moment. Inside, we found a 20-foot square storage area holding just one item. The throne of Mnemosyne hardly deserved the name throne. It was a straight-backed chair of sanded white birch, devoid of decoration except for the carved silhouette of a mountain on the seat back. Ugh, Mnemosyne. Give me a proper golden throne encrusted with ever-flaming rubies. Alas, not every deity knows how to flaunt it. Still, the chair's simplicity made me nervous. I found that many terrible and powerful items are quite underwhelming in appearance. Zeus's lightning bolts? They don't look menacing until my father throws them. The trident of Poseidon? Please! He never scrubs the seaweed and moss off that thing. And the wedding dress Helen of Troy wore to marry Menelaus? Oh, gods, it was so drab. I told her, girl, you have got to be kidding me. That neckline doesn't work for you at all. Then Helen put it on, and wow.
What's the mountain design?
Meg stirred me from my reverie.
Olympus? Actually, no. I'm guessing that would be Mount Pyrrhus, where the goddess Demosthene gave birth to the nine muses. Meg scrunched up her face.
All nine of them at once? Sounds painful.
I'd never thought about that. Since Demosthene was the goddess of memory, with every detail of her eternal existence engraved on her brain, it did seem strange that she'd want a reminder of her labor and delivery experience carved on her throne. Whatever the case, I said, we've tarried too long. Let's get the chair out of here. I used my roll of medical tape to make shoulder straps, turning the chair into a makeshift backpack. Who said Leo was the only handy person on our team? Meg, I said, while I'm doing this, fill those syringes with ammonia.
Why?
Just for emergencies. Humor me. Medical tape is wonderful stuff. Soon, Meg and I both had bandoliers of ammonia syringes, and I had a chair on my back. The throne was a light piece of furniture, which was fortunate since it was knocking around with my ukulele, my bow, and my quiver. I added a few scalpels to my bandolier, just for fun. Now all I needed was a bass drum and some juggling pins, and I could be a one-man traveling show. I hesitated in the corridor. In one direction, the hallway extended about 100 feet before angling left. The alarms had stopped blaring, but from around that corner came an echoing roar, like ocean surf or a cheering crowd. Multicolored lights flashed across the walls. Just looking in that direction made me nervous. Our only other option would take us back to the Meg McCaffrey Memorial Wall of Chia. Fastest exit, I said. We may have to retrace our steps. Meg stood enthralled, her ear tilted toward the distant roar.
There's something down there. We need to check it out.
Please, no, I begged.
We've rescued the prisoners. We found Festus. We scored a lovely piece of furniture. That's a full day's work for any hero.
Meg straightened.
Something important, she insisted.
She summoned her swords and strode toward the strange lights in the distance.
I hate you,
I muttered.
Then I shouldered my magical chair and jogged after her, around the corner and straight into a vast, spotlighted arena. 25. Big birds are evil. They charge me with razor legs. I die, and it hurts. I was no stranger to stadium concerts. In ancient times, I played a dozen sold-out shows at the amphitheater in Ephesus. Frenzied young women threw their strophia at me. Young men swooned and fainted. In 1965, I sang with the Beatles at Shea Stadium, though Paul would not agree to turn up my microphone. On the recordings, you can't even hear my voice on Everybody's Trying to Be My Baby. However, none of my previous experiences prepared me for the Emperor's arena. Spotlights blinded me as we emerged from the corridor. The crowd cheered. As my eyes adjusted, I saw that we stood at the 50-yard line of a professional football stadium. The field was arranged in an odd fashion. Around the circumference ran a 3-lane racetrack. Pincushioning the artificial turf, a dozen iron posts anchored the chains of various beasts. At one post, 6 combat ostriches paced like dangerous merry-go-round animals. At another, 3 male lions snarled and blinked at the spotlights. At a third, a sad-looking elephant swayed. No doubt unhappy that she'd been outfitted in spiked chainmail and an oversized Colts football helmet. Reluctantly, I raised my eyes to the stands. In the sea of blue seats, The only occupied section was the end zone on the left. But the crowd was certainly enthusiastic. Germani banged their spears against their shields. The demigods of Commodus's imperial household jeered and yelled insults, which I will not repeat, about my divine person. Cynocephali, the tribe of wolf-headed men, howled and tore at their Indianapolis Colts souvenir jerseys. Rows of blemmyi clapped politely, looking perplexed at the rude behavior of their peers, and predictably, an entire section of the stands was filled with wild centaurs. Honestly, you can't have a sporting event or bloodbath anywhere without them somehow getting wind of it. They blew their vuvuzelas, sounded air horns, and trampled all over one another, sloshing root beer from their double-cup drinking hats. In the center of the crowd gleamed the Emperor's box, bedecked in purple and gold banners that clashed horribly with the blue and steel Colt's decor. Flanking the throne were a grim mix of Germani and mortal mercenaries with sniper rifles. What the mercenaries saw through the mist, I couldn't guess, but they must have been specially trained to work in magical environments. They stood emotionless and alert, their fingers resting across their triggers. I didn't doubt that they would kill us at one word from Commodus, and we would be powerless to stop them. Commodus himself rose from his throne. He wore white and purple robes and a golden laurel crown, as one would expect of an emperor. But under the folds of his toga, I caught a glimpse of a golden brown racing suit. With his shaggy beard, Commodus looked more like a Gallic chieftain than a Roman, though no Gaul would have such perfect gleaming white teeth.
At last!
His commanding voice boomed through the stadium, amplified by giant speakers that hung above the field.
Welcome, Apollo!
The audience cheered and hooted. Lining the upper tiers, TV screens flashed digital fireworks and blazed the words, Welcome, Apollo. High above, along the girders of the corrugated steel roof, bags of confetti burst, dumping a snowstorm of purple and gold that swirled around the championship banners.
Oh, the irony. This was exactly the sort of welcome I'd been longing for.
Now I just wanted to slink back into the corridor and disappear. But of course, the doorway we'd come through had disappeared, replaced with a cinder block wall. I crouched as inconspicuously as possible and pressed the indentation on my iron manacle. No wings sprang from the shackle, so I guessed I'd found the right button for the emergency signal. With luck, it would alert Joe and Emmy to our plight and location, though I still wasn't sure what they could do to help us. At least they'd know where to collect our bodies later. Meg seemed to be withdrawing into herself, rolling down her mental shutters against the onslaught of noise and attention. For a brief, terrible moment, I wondered if she might have betrayed me once again, leading me right into the clutches of the triumvirate. No. I refused to believe it. And yet, why had she insisted on coming this direction? Commodus waited for the roar of the crowd to subside. Combat ostriches strained at their tethers. Lions roared. The elephant shook her head as if trying to remove her ridiculous Colt's helmet. Meg, I said, trying to control my panic. Why are we? Her expression was as mystified as the demigods at Camp Half-Blood, who'd been drawn to the Grove of Dodona by its mysterious voices.
Something, she murmured. Something is here.
That was a horrifying understatement. Many things were here. Most of them wanted to kill us.
The video screens flashed more fireworks, along with digital nonsense like defense and make some noise and advertisements for energy drinks. My eyes felt as if they were bleeding. Commodus grinned down at me.
I had to rush things, old friend. This is just the dress rehearsal. But since you're here, I scrambled to put together a few surprises. We'll restage the whole show tomorrow with a full audience. After I bulldoze the waystation to the ground? Do try to stay alive today, but you're welcome to suffer as much as you want. And Meg.
His tisk, tisk, tisk echoed through the stadium.
Your stepfather is so disappointed in you. You're about to find out just how much.
Meg pointed one of her swords at the Emperor's box. I waited for her to issue some withering retort like, "You're stupid." But the sword seemed to be her entire message. This brought back an unsettling memory of Commodus himself in the Colosseum, tossing severed ostrich heads at the senator's seats and pointing, "You're next." But Meg couldn't have known about that, could she? Commodus's smile wavered. He held up a page of notes.
So, anyway, the run of show. First, the citizens of Indianapolis are marched in at gunpoint and seated. I'll say a few words, thank them for coming, and explain how their city is now named Commodianapolis.
The crowd howled and stomped. A lone air horn blasted.
Yes, yes.
Commodus waved away their enthusiasm.
Then I send an army of Blemii into the city with champagne bottles to smash against all the buildings. My banners are unfurled along all the streets. Any bodies we retrieve from the waystation are dangled on ropes from the girders up there.
He gestured at the peaked ceiling.
And then the fun starts.
He threw his notes in the air.
I can't tell you how excited I am, Apollo. You understand, don't you? This was all preordained. The spirit of Trophonius was very specific.
My throat made the sound of a vuvuzela. You consulted the Dark Oracle? I wasn't sure my words would carry that far, but the Emperor laughed.
Well, of course, dear heart. Not me, personally. I have minions to do that sort of thing. But Trophonius was quite clear. Once I destroy the waystation and sacrifice your life in the games, only then can I rechristen this city and rule the Midwest forever as God Emperor.
Twin spotlights fixed on Commodus. He ripped off his toga, revealing a one-piece racing suit of Nemean lionhide. The front and sleeves decorated with the decals of various corporate sponsors. The crowd oohed and awed as the Emperor turned a circle, showing off his outfit.
You like? He asked. I've done a lot of research on my new hometown. My two fellow emperors call this place boring. But I will prove them wrong. I will stage the best IndyCult 500 AA gladiatorial championship ever.
Personally, I thought Commodus's branding needed work, but the crowd went wild. Everything seemed to happen at once. Country music blared from the speakers, possibly Jason Aldean, though with the distortion and reverb, even my keen ears could not be sure. At the opposite side of the track, a wall opened. Three Formula One race cars, red, yellow, and blue, like a children's toy set, rumbled onto the tarmac. Around the field, chains disconnected from the animals' collars. In the stands, wild centaurs threw fruit and blew their vuvuzelas. From somewhere behind the Emperor's box, cannons fired, launching a dozen gladiators over the goalposts toward the field. Some landed with graceful rolls and came up ready to fight. Others hit the artificial turf like heavily armored spitwads and didn't move again. The race cars revved and sped around the track, forcing Meg and me onto the field to avoid getting run over. Gladiators and animals began a free-for-all, no claws barred destructo match to the Nashville beat. And then, for no logical reason, a huge sack opened under the Jumbotron monitor, spilling hundreds of basketballs onto the 50-yard line. Even by Comitus's standards, the spectacle was crass and too much of everything. But I doubted I would live long enough to write a bad review. Adrenaline raced through my system like a 220-volt current. Meg yelled and charged the nearest ostrich. Since I had nothing better to do, I raced after her, the throne of Mnemosyne and 30 pounds of other gear bouncing on my back. All six ostriches bore down on us. That may not sound as terrifying as the Carthaginian serpent or a bronze colossus of moi, but ostriches can run at 40 miles an hour. They charged with their metal teeth snapping, their spiked helmets swiping side to side, their barbed wire legs trampling across the turf like an ugly pink forest of deadly Christmas trees. I knocked an arrow in my bow, but even if I could match Comitus's skill, I doubted I could decapitate all six birds before they killed us. I wasn't even sure Meg could defeat so many with her formidable blades. I silently composed a new death haiku right on the spot. Big birds are evil. They charge me with razor legs. I die. And it hurts. In my defense, I did not have much time to edit. The only thing that saved us? Basketballs ex machina. Another bag must have opened above us, or perhaps a small batch of balls had gotten stuck in the netting. 20 or 30 rained down around us, forcing the ostriches to dodge and veer. One less fortunate bird stepped on a ball and took a header, planting his sharpened beak in the turf. Two of his brethren stumbled over him, creating a dangerous pileup of feathers, legs, and razor wire.
"Come on!"
Meg yelled to me. Rather than fighting the birds, she grabbed one's neck and swung onto its back, somehow without dying. She charged away, swinging her blades at monsters and gladiators. Mildly impressive, but how was I supposed to follow her? Also, she just rendered useless my plan of hiding behind her. Such an inconsiderate girl. I shot my arrow at the nearest threat, a cyclops charging me and waving his club. Where he'd come from, I had no idea. But I sent him back to Tartarus where he belonged. I dodged a fire-breathing horse, kicked a basketball into the gut of a gladiator, then sidestepped a lion who was lunging at a tasty-looking ostrich. All of this, by the way, with a chair strapped to my back. Meg aimed her deadly bird at the Emperor's box, slashing down anything that got in her way. I understood her plan. Kill Comitus. I staggered after her as best I could, but my head throbbed from the pounding country music, the jeering of the crowd, and the whine of the Formula One engines gaining speed around the track. A pack of wolf-headed warriors loped toward me. Too many. At too close range for my bow. I ripped off my bandolier of medical syringes and squirted ammonia in their lupine faces. They screamed, clawing their eyes, and began to crumble to dust. As any Mount Olympian custodian can tell you, ammonia is an excellent cleaning agent for monsters and other blemishes. I made my way toward the only island of calm on the field. The elephant. She did not seem interested in attacking anyone. Given her size and formidable chainmail defenses, none of the other combatants seemed anxious to approach her. Or perhaps, seeing her Colt's helmet, they simply didn't want to mess with the home team. Something about her was so sad, so despondent, I felt drawn to her as a kindred spirit.
I pulled out my combat ukulele and strummed an elephant-friendly song, Primus's Southbound Pachyderm. The instrumental intro was haunting and sad, perfect for solo ukulele.
Great elephant, I sang as I approached. May I ride you?
Her wet brown eyes blinked at me. She huffed as if to say, whatever, Apollo. They got me wearing this stupid helmet. I don't even care anymore. A gladiator with a trident rudely interrupted my song. I smashed him in the face with my combat ukulele. Then I used the elephant's foreleg to climb onto her back. I hadn't practiced that technique since the storm god Indra took me on a late-night road trip in search of Vindaloo. But I guess riding an elephant is one of those skills you never forget. I spotted Meg at the 20-yard line, leaving groaning gladiators and piles of monster ash in her wake as she rode her ostrich toward the Emperor. Commodus clapped with delight.
Well done, Meg. I'd love to fight you, but hold that thought.
The music abruptly shut off. Gladiators stopped in mid-combat. The race cars slowed to an idle. Even Meg's ostrich paused and looked around as if wondering why it was suddenly so quiet. Over the speakers came a dramatic drumroll.
Meg McCaffrey!
Commodus boomed in his best game show announcer voice.
We've got a special surprise for you. Straight from New York. Someone you know. Can you save him before he bursts into flames?
Spotlight beams crossed in midair at a point above the end zone, level with the top of the goalposts. That old post-Vindaloo feeling came back to me, burning its way through my intestines. Now I understood what Meg had sensed earlier. That vague something that had drawn her into the stadium. Suspended from the rafters by a long chain, snarling and wriggling in a rope cocoon, was the Emperor's special surprise. Meg's trusty sidekick, the Karpos Peaches. 26. I tip my hat to the excellent elephant. Let's be besties, okay? I knocked an arrow and fired at the chain. In most circumstances, my first instinct was to shoot. Usually this worked out. Unless you count the time Hermes burst into my bathroom without knocking. And yes, I always keep my bow handy when I'm on the toilet. Why would I not? This time my shot was ill-planned. Peaches struggled and swung so much, my arrow sailed past his chain and felled a random blemmyi in the stands.
Stop! Meg shrieked at me. You might hit Peaches.
The Emperor laughed.
Yes, that would be a shame when he's about to burn to death.
Commodus leaped from his box onto the racetrack. Meg raised her sword and prepared to charge. But mercenaries in the stands leveled their rifles. No matter that I was 50 yards away, the snipers had aim worthy of, well, me. A swarm of red targeting dots floated over my chest.
Now, Meg, the Emperor chided, pointing to me. My game, my rules. Unless you want to lose two friends in the dress rehearsal.
Meg lifted one sword, then the other, weighing them like options. She was too far away for me to clearly see her expression, but I could sense her agony. How many times had I been caught in such a dilemma? Do I destroy the Trojans or the Greeks? Do I flirt with my sister's hunters and risk getting slapped? Or do I flirt with Britomartis and risk getting blown up? These are the kinds of choices that define us. As Meg hesitated, a pit crew in togas rolled another Formula One car onto the track. A bright purple machine with a golden number one on the hood. Protruding from the roof was a wiry lance about 20 feet tall, topped with a wad of cloth. My first thought, why did Commodus need such a big antenna? Then I looked again at the dangling Karpos. In the spotlights, Peaches glistened as if he'd been slathered with grease. His feet, usually bare, were covered in rough sandpaper, like the striking surface of a matchbook. My gut twisted. The race car's antenna wasn't an antenna. It was a giant match, set at just the right height to ignite against Peaches's feet.
Once I'm in the car, Commodus announced, my mercenaries will not interfere. Meg, you may try to stop me any way you please. My plan is to complete one circuit, light your friend on fire, then circle back around and hit you and Apollo with my car. I believe they call that a victory lap.
The crowd roared with approval. Commodus leaped into his car. His pit crew scattered, and the purple racer peeled out in a cloud of smoke. My blood turned to cold-pressed olive oil, pumping sluggishly through my heart. How long would it take for that race car to get around the track? Seconds, at most. I suspected Commodus's windshield was aeroproof. He wouldn't leave me such an easy solution. I didn't even have time for a decent ukulele riff. Meanwhile, Meg guided her ostrich under the swinging Karpos. She stood on the bird's back, no easy task, and reached as high as she could. But Peaches was much too far above her.
Turn into a fruit,
Meg shouted up at him.
Disappear.
Peaches,
Peaches wailed, which probably meant, don't you think I would if I could? I guessed that the ropes were somehow magically restricting his shape-shifting, confining him to his present form, much as Zeus had shoehorned my awesome divinity into the miserable body of Lester Papadopoulos. For the first time, I felt a kinship with the diapered demon baby. Commodus was now halfway around the track. He could have gone faster, but he insisted on swerving and waving to the cameras. The other race cars pulled over to let him pass, making me wonder if they understood the concept of racing. Meg leaped from the ostrich's back. She caught the goalpost's crossbeam and began to climb. But I knew she wouldn't have time to help the Karpos. The purple car rounded the far end zone. If Commodus accelerated in the straightaway, it would all be over. If only I could block his path with something large and heavy. Oh, wait, thought my genius brain. I am sitting on an elephant. Engraved across the base of the massive colt's helmet was the name Livia. I assumed that was the elephant's. I leaned forward. Livia, my friend, do you feel like stomping an emperor? She trumpeted, her first real show of enthusiasm. I knew elephants were intelligent, but her willingness to help surprised me. I got the feeling that Commodus had treated her terribly. Now she wanted to kill him. This, at least, we had in common. Livia charged toward the track, shouldering other animals aside, sweeping her trunk to smack gladiators out of our path.
Good elephant, I cried.
Excellent elephant.
The throne of memory bounced precariously on my back. I spent all of my arrows, except the stupid talking one, shooting down combat ostriches, fire-breathing horses, cyclopes, and cynocephali. Then I snatched up my combat ukulele and played the bugle call for charge. Livia barreled down the center lane, heading for the purple race car. Commodus veered straight toward us, his grinning face reflected on every video monitor around the stadium. He looked delighted by the prospect of a head-on collision. Me, not so much. Commodus was hard to kill. My elephant and I were not.
nor was I sure how much protection Livia's chainmail would give her. I'd been hoping we might force Commodus off the road, but I should have known he would never back down in a game of chicken. Without a helmet, his hair flapped wildly around him, making his golden laurels look like they were on fire. Without a helmet. I pulled a scalpel from my bandolier. Leaning forward, I sawed through the chin strap off Livia's football helmet. It snapped easily. Thank the gods for cheap plastic merchandise. Livia, I said, throw it! The excellent elephant understood. Still charging full speed ahead, she curled her trunk around her face guard and flung the helmet like a gentleman tipping his hat. If that hat were allowed to hurtle forward as a deadly projectile. Commodus swerved. The giant white helmet bounced off his windshield, but the real damage had been done. Purple One vaulted onto the field at an impossibly steep angle, canted sideways, and flipped three times, bowling over a herd of ostriches and a couple of unlucky gladiators. Oh! The crowd rose to its feet. The music stopped. The remaining gladiators backed toward the edge of the field, eyeing the overturned Imperial race car. Smoke poured from the chassis. The wheels spun, sloughing off shavings of tread. I wanted to believe the crowd's silence was a hopeful pause. Perhaps, like me, their fondest wish was that Commodus would not emerge from the wreckage, that he had been reduced to an Imperial smear on the artificial turf at the 42-yard line. Alas, a steaming figure crawled from the wreckage. Commodus's beard smoldered. His face and hands were black with soot. He rose, his smile undimmed, and stretched as if he'd just had a good nap.
Nice one, Apollo!
He grabbed the chassis of the ruined race car and lifted it over his head.
But it will take more than this to kill me!
He tossed the car aside, flattening an unfortunate cyclops. The audience cheered and stomped. The Emperor called,
"Clear the field!"
Immediately, dozens of animal handlers, medics, and ball retrievers rushed onto the turf. The surviving gladiators sulked away, as if realizing no fight to the death could compete with what Commodus had just done. As the Emperor ordered his servants around, I glanced toward the end zone. Somehow Meg had climbed all the way to the top of the goalpost. She leaped toward Peaches and caught his legs, causing a great deal of screeching and cursing from the carpos. For a moment, they swung together from the chain. Then Meg climbed her friend's body, summoned her sword, and slashed the chain. They dropped 20 feet, landing on the track in a heap. Happily, Peaches acted as a cushion for Meg. Given the soft, squishy nature of peach fruit, I imagined Meg would be fine.
Well,
Commodus strode toward me. He limped slightly on his right ankle, but if it caused him any serious pain, he gave no sign.
That was a good rehearsal. Tomorrow, more deaths, including yours, of course. We'll tweak the combat phase. Perhaps add a few more race cars and basketballs. And Livia, you naughty old elephant.
He wagged his finger at my pachyderm mount.
That's the sort of energy I was looking for. If you'd showed that much enthusiasm in our previous games, I wouldn't have had to kill Claudius.
Livia stomped and trumpeted. I stroked the side of her head, trying to calm her, but I could feel her intense anguish. Claudius was your mate, I guessed. Commodus killed him. The Emperor shrugged.
I did warn her. Play my games or else. But elephants are so stubborn. They're big and strong and used to getting their way. Rather like gods.
Still, he winked at me.
It's amazing what a little punishment can accomplish.
Livia stamped her feet. I knew she wanted to charge, but after seeing Commodus toss a race car, I suspected he would have little trouble hurting Livia. We will get him, I murmured to her. Just wait.
Yes, until tomorrow, Commodus agreed. You'll get another chance to do your worst. But for now, here come my guards to escort you to your cell.
A squadron of Germani hustled onto the field with Laterces in the lead. Across his face, the Cornhusker had an ugly new bruise that looked suspiciously like an ostrich's footprint. That pleased me. He was also bleeding from several new cuts on his arms, and his pant legs were slashed to ribbons. The rips looked like grazes from small game arrowheads, as if the hunters had been toying with their target, doing their best to eliminate his trousers. This pleased me even more. I wished I could add a new arrow wound to Laterces' collection. Preferably one right in the middle of his sternum. But my quiver was empty except for the arrow of Dodona. I'd had enough drama for one day without adding bad Shakespearean dialogue. Laterces bowed awkwardly. My lord. Commodus and I spoke in unison. Yes? I thought I looked much more lordly sitting atop my chainmail elephant, but Laterces just sneered at me.
My lord Commodus, he clarified. The invaders have been pushed back from the main gates.
About time, the emperor muttered.
They were hunters of Artemis, sire.
I see.
Commodus didn't sound particularly concerned.
Did you kill them all?
We, Lit gulped.
No, my lord. They sniped at us from multiple positions and fell back, leading us into a series of traps. We only lost 10 men, but...
You lost 10.
Commodus examined his soot-stained fingernails.
And how many of these hunters did you kill?
Lit edged away. His neck veins pulsed.
I am not sure. We found no bodies.
So you cannot confirm any kills?
Commodus glanced at me.
What would you advise, Apollo? Should I take time to reflect?
Should I consider the consequences? Should I perhaps tell my prefect Laterces not to worry? He will be fine. He will always have my blessings.
This last line he screamed, his voice echoing through the stadium. Even the wild centaurs in the stands fell quiet.
No.
Commodus decided, his tone once again calm.
Alaric, where are you?
One of the Germani stepped forward.
Sire.
Take Apollo and Meg McCaffrey into custody. See that they get nice cells for the night. Put the throne of Mnemosyne back into storage. Kill the elephant and the carpos. What else?
Oh, yes.
From the boot of his racing suit, Commodus pulled a hunting knife.
Hold Laterces' arms for me while I cut his throat. It's time for a new prefect.
Before Alaric could carry out these orders, the stadium's roof exploded. 27. Destroy me a roof. Bring me wenches with winches. We're so out of here. Well, I say exploded. More accurately, the roof crumpled inward, as roofs tend to do when a bronze dragon smashes into them. Girders bent, rivets popped, sheets of corrugated metal groaned and folded with a sound like colliding aircraft carriers. Festus plummeted through the gap, his wings unfolding to slow his descent. He seemed no worse for wear from his time in suitcase form. But judging from the way he blowtorched the audience in the stands, I guessed he was feeling a bit cranky. Wild centaurs stampeded, trampling the mortal mercenaries and Germani. The Blemyai clapped politely, perhaps thinking the dragon was part of the show, until a wave of flames reduced them to dust. Festus flew his own fiery victory lap around the track, torching race cars, as a dozen silvery ropes uncoiled from the roof, lowering the hunters of Artemis into the arena like a cluster of spiders. I've always found spiders fascinating creatures, despite what Athena thinks. If you ask me, she's just jealous of their beautiful faces. Boom! More hunters remained on the roofline with their bows drawn, laying down suppressing fire as their sisters lowered themselves to the field. As soon as the repellers hit the turf, they drew bows, swords, and knives and leaped into battle. Alaric, along with most of the Emperor's Germani, charged to meet them. At the goalpost, Meg McCaffrey worked frantically to cut Peaches free from his ropes. Two hunters dropped next to her. They had a hurried conversation with lots of pointing, something along the lines of, "Hello, we are your friends. You're going to die. Come with us." Clearly agitated, Meg glanced across the field in my direction. I yelled, "Go!" Meg allowed the hunters to grab her and Peaches. Then the hunters slapped some sort of mechanisms on the sides of their belts and shot back up their ropes as if the laws of gravity were mere recommendations. Motorized winches, I thought, a very nice accessory. If I live through this, I'm going to recommend that the hunters of Artemis make t-shirts that read, "Winches with Winches." I'm sure they'll love that idea. The closest group of hunters charged in my direction, meeting the Germani in battle. One of the hunters looked familiar, with choppy black hair and dazzling blue eyes. Instead of the usual gray camo of Artemis's followers, she wore jeans and a black leather jacket that was held together with safety pins and had patches for the Ramones and dead Kennedys. A silver tiara glinted on her forehead. On one arm, she brandished a shield imprinted with the gruesome visage of Medusa. Not the original, I suspected, since that would have turned me to stone, but a good enough replica to make even the Germani cower and back away. The girl's name came to me. Thalia Grace, Artemis's lieutenant, the leader of the hunters, had personally come to rescue me. "Save Apollo!" she yelled. My spirits soared. "Yes, thank you," I wanted to yell. "Finally, someone has their priorities straight." I felt for a moment as if the world were back in its proper order.
Commodus sighed in exasperation. "I did not schedule this for my games."
He looked around, apparently just realizing he had only two guards and Laterces left to command. The rest were already in combat.
"Laterces, get out there," he snapped. "Slow them down while I go change.